Hi there. Before we begin, let me explain something. This 12-part series was made at WYSO, a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO's staff and infrastructure to get the job done. We'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org. Thanks. Hi, I'm Nina Ellis, and this is The Ohio Country, Episode 7, Tecumseh's Legacy.
And I'm Chris Welter. Chances are good that you've heard of the Shawnee leader Tecumseh. His name is everywhere in Ohio. Today we take a deep dive into his legacy in Ohio and how he's regarded among Shawnee today.
Stay with us. It's The Ohio Country from public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Mention the name Mad Anthony Wayne, and you'll stir up mixed emotions in Ohio today, more than 200 years after his death. He was the Revolutionary War general sent here to vanquish the native tribes so Americans could settle north of the Ohio River. In 2023, a dozen indigenous nations with roots in Southeast Ohio asked the U.S. Forest Service to rename Ohio's Wayne National Forest. Reporter Aaron Gottsacker of the Ohio Newsroom asked Shawnee Chief Ben Barnes about that.
Why do you think it's so important to rename the Wayne National Forest?
In regards to Anthony Wayne, even in his own time, he faced criticism from his own peers for being over the top in his murderous zealotry, trying to rid the Ohio of indigenous people. So in Ohio today, modern Ohio, includes people of a great diversity, and it should represent all of Ohioans, not just a town burner, destroyer of communities, murderer of women and children.
Chief Ben Barnes of the Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. There were many Shawnee who fought against General Wayne, and their suffering was real. Their villages were burned, their crops were destroyed, there was starvation and death. Dr. Mary Stockwell is an Ohio historian who wrote a biography of Anthony Wayne called Unlikely General, Mad Anthony Wayne and the Battle for America. Stockwell's ancestors fought against Wayne's army in the Ohio country, too. They were Irish immigrants siding with the British, allied with the Shawnee. She says most people she talks to agree with Chief Barnes. They think Wayne was a genocidal maniac. Wayne definitely had a temper, she says. He was depressed at times, erratic, and full of contradictions. He was loyal to the United States, a keen strategist who feared the tribes and respected their skills. When he was sent to the Ohio country by President Washington, she says, this is what he told himself, based on her research.
I hope I can negotiate a peace because I cannot beat these people. They are the greatest warriors. They are the greatest diplomats. They are beyond anything I can get. I have no army. I have no officers. The thought that I have to go out into the wilderness terrified him. Anthony Wayne was absolutely terrified.
No kidding.
Never thought he would win. Washington didn't think he would win. Washington was willing to negotiate away Ohio and let the tribes just have it because he said, if we go into another battle, lose another army, it's going to be a disaster.
Washington and Wayne both understood how the tribes had defeated two American generals in 2 years. And when Wayne arrived in 1791, tribes were feeling sure that their fighting with the Americans was over.
And you can sort of see in the time period why they would have thought this was the end of things. There's no way a nation could come back from a defeat like that. They were wrong in that assumption.
This is George Ironstrack, a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. He teaches history at the Miamia Center at Miami University. His ancestors fought against Wayne, too, led by Chief Little Turtle, one of the tribal leaders who observed as Wayne built an army of 1,000 men in Ohio, trained them to have confidence, and built a 200-mile-long supply line from the Ohio River north to go after them. Everything had to be transported. Tents, livestock, cannons, up a narrow road. It took 3 years. There were lots of desertions. Wayne moved them gradually north, building 6 forts along the way.
Many historians who look at this period of time, you know, really say it's Wayne's, Anthony Wayne's organizational skills that really seal the fate in a negative way for our nations during that more lengthy campaign. His organization of the fighting soldiers, but also organization of the supplies and of the building of the chain of forts were really the critical moments in a long, drawn-out campaign.
The chiefs who watched this unfolding, says Ironstrack, were brilliant military strategists in their own right.
And they knew and made requests for cannon. They knew that the only way to obstruct this form of advancement that Wayne was taking was to lay siege to forts and actually defeat them with cannon.
But their British allies wouldn't give them cannons. They gave guns and ammunition, but drew the line at cannons, thinking the U.S. would see that as an act of war.
And so without cannon from the British, they knew they were not going to be able to effectively stop the advancement of the U.S. Army.
After 3 years, 9 tribes met Wayne's Legion near present-day Toledo in the Battle of Fallen Timbers. It was the Wyandot, Mohawk, Miami, Delaware, Shawnee, Ottawa, Potawatomi, and Ojibwe, plus some Canadian militia. Wayne fired 16 cannons, and in less than 2 hours, the tribes were overwhelmed. Some ran 4 miles upriver to a British fort for safety. Canadians were let in, the story goes, but the British betrayed the tribes and closed the gates on them. And without their British allies, the tribes were running out of options.
Whatever happened in that battle, everything was set up for Wayne to just continue to attack and destroy and keep soldiers in the field in our homelands in the Wabash and Maumee River valleys that at that time we just lacked the ability to stop that.
Wayne ordered his troops to burn villages and farm fields along the Maumee River and then built a fort at Kikionga, a Miami village, today's Fort Wayne, Indiana. The general went back to Fort Greenville to prepare a peace treaty. And in the next year, one by one, the tribe sent representatives to meet with him.
And eventually, my ancestor, Pinjiwa, Jean-Baptiste Richardville, came in and entered into pre-negotiations with Anthony Wayne, and he was a very young man at the time, but other civil leaders were absent. Either they had fled the area or they were in Detroit trying to get the British to help. And so he was selected by his community to represent them in the pre-negotiations, and he actually agreed to numerous articles almost in the exact way that they'll show up in the final treaty. So it's clear that Wayne's sketching out what he wants to accomplish at the treaty, and he's running it by these leaders. You know, the nice way to put it is checking to see what they think about it. You know, the more harsher, cynical way is, you know, you're all starving because we destroyed all your food. And do you want war to continue or do you want peace? If you want peace, here are the terms we're laying out.
I asked George Ironstrack, did the tribes respect Wayne, and did Wayne respect the tribes? Some of both, he says. The Americans definitely saw the tribes as sovereign nations, he says, and needed them to recognize the legitimacy of the U.S., because for one thing, America desperately needed the income from the sale of land.
I would guess that, yes, Wayne respected these leaders, or at least he knew enough to behave respectfully according to our own values, which is an interesting thing to come out of this period of time of intense destructive warfare. After they pass out of that, they actually do engage in what we would consider to be legitimate diplomatic protocols. It seems as though many of the leaders at that treaty came to respect him as well.
When the Treaty of Greenville was all signed, boundary lines were drawn, and the tribes were moved north.
And, you know, folks have speculated what would have happened in the years that followed if he hadn't died, because, you know, folks who follow him do not necessarily behave as respectfully.
Mary Stockwell says Wayne had a feeling about what was to come.
And he used to tell the Indians, you know, my people are going to come and cross the line, Defend your tribe. Defend your land. You don't have to hand over everything. There should be a way. He thought everybody could live together. Washington believed it, too. Washington thought, eventually, maybe 50 years, we will blend together. We'll live in peace. We'll trade. And somehow, we'll be one big happy nation.
After the Treaty of Greenville, Indian land was surveyed and sold to settlers, who kept coming in by the thousands. But a new generation of tribal leaders was coming of age, who would push back against American encroachment again, including Tecumseh. You're listening to The Ohio Country from the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Tecumseh is the one Shawnee from Ohio's past that most people today can name. Talon Silverhorn, a citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma, is a professional historic interpreter. He's thought a lot about what the legacy of Tecumseh means to his Shawnee people today.
Can you talk about Tecumseh's generation, kind of what they had experienced growing up and kind of where they found themselves in adulthood?
Yeah, so Tecumseh was born roughly 1768 at the end of the French and Indian War, most likely near Springfield, Ohio. And from the time that he was born to the time that he was 20 years old, I mean, his home had been destroyed several times. His mother had left. His father was killed at the Battle of Point Pleasant in 1774 during Lord Dunmore's War. His mother, as far as I know, left and went down to what is now Missouri with some Shawnee people who were going to live, you know, there on Spanish land grants. And then his older sister and his brothers, you know, they sort of stuck together, probably whatever family was left on their mother's side there. From there, he sort of learns from his older brother and his older sister. He likely plays an active role within his community as a young man. And then with people like Joseph Brant and Blue Jacket and others, he's sort of beginning now to learn military strategy and warfare and politics and the things that are sort of being taught to him by these older men, like I said, especially Brant and Blue Jacket. And so he begins to fight. He begins to raid, you know, riverways. So they're doing a lot of guerrilla warfare type stuff. They're like cutting off supply lines. They're attacking ships on the river. You know, they are like kind of doing highwayman kind of stuff. But it is very effective. And then the sort of catalyst event for Tecumseh is he witnesses the burning and torture of an American prisoner. And, you know, it was recorded that he kind of freaked out a little bit and sort of saw that if we weren't careful, you could end up doing exactly the same kind of things that, you know, you are sort of arguing and fighting against. So, you know, don't become the monster that you know, claiming to oppose. And that's really when we start to see his shift to a really strong kind of political negotiator and orator. And so, you know, growing up, his experiences in the world first, you know, as a traumatized young man with both of his parents gone, to a warrior fighting because that is the norm at this point in time, you know, fighting against colonization and against American settlements and those types of things, to realizing that there's probably no military way to win this fight. It's the same conclusion that people like Blue Jacket and Black Hoof and others are coming to, which is that militarily speaking, there's probably no great way to win this. And so, you know, it's either join or find a different way to sort of challenge this and promote the survival of the community, because there are people that would fight to the last man. But what good would that do our community to fight to the last living soul and then we all be gone and the fight was for what? So I think, you know, Tecumseh is sort of beginning to now look at the survival of the community and the recognition of the community as kind of paramount in importance. Military force is still a part of that mission, and I think that helps to draw a lot of attention, and especially in the minds of the American people, that is the way you get their attention. And so, you know, with one hand, he is a warrior, and on the other hand, he is a politician and a speaker. He's trying to play both sides of what Americans are going to respect and look for, so.
Talon Silverhorn grew up hearing stories about Tecumseh and his brother, the Prophet, from their direct descendants.
So growing up in Oklahoma, you know, with the descendants of you know, this prominent family, there was a lot of that kind of, well, I've always been told this, or I've always been told that. And then, you know, moving outside of Oklahoma, now living in Ohio, I hear a lot of the same things, but what follows that phrase is often very different. So, well, I was always told, you know, and then something very different from what I hear from, you know, Shawnee people. I think a lot of the conversations, you know, and the context that people place Tecumseh in depends on their education and depends on, you know, sort of how they view the progression of American history. So, you know, within a lot of tribal communities, we see the progression of history as a familial sort of pattern, you know, from generation to generation, from mothers to daughters and fathers to sons, et cetera, and sort of a continuation of community, where I think a lot of, especially American culture, views history as a progression of military events. Everything is sort of framed around what war is going on at that particular time. And so, you know, Tecumseh serves as one of these sort of milestones. You know, him and the prophet and Harrison and Jefferson, you know, they all kind of serve as the sort of milestone names for that particular period of history. And so a lot of the legends and stories and even fabrications around these people sort of fit that narrative. They fall into those categories where, you know, a lot of our Shawnee people talk about Tecumseh in a more familiar sense, in a sense that he was preserving community, that he was, you know, doing things like promoting friendship and sort of unity amongst the tribes. And then a lot of Americans, you know, talk about him as an opponent, as a military figure. So, you know, in Ohio, you know, as I've been digging more into the specific history related to this area, you know, kind of the greater Dayton area, the little Miami Valley, I've identified a couple of places that, you know, claim to be Tecumseh's birthplace and have a very strong connection to him as a boy. And Tecumseh swam in my farm pond and he, you know, et cetera. So there's lots of little connections like that. Tecumseh held this stone that I have on my mantle. And so I think he's sort of taken on the, you know, the image of Elvis on a piece of toast kind of trope, that he is a very famous figure that, you know, everyone kind of sees everywhere.
So I you know, I have to admit, I think our station in the past has kind of fallen for this sort of talking to people that have these legends attached to someone like Tecumseh, like, oh, that tree there is where Tecumseh used to tie his canoe. Or I've heard the same thing, that, oh, this spot in the river is where Tecumseh used to break through the ice and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I guess I'm trying to ask really directly, like, how do you feel when you hear legends like that that are probably just that, legends?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings. I would say it can be very positive. One very prominent example of sort of like historical fiction and legends and sort of things that are repeated without, you know, much of a factual basis. There's a lot of historical fiction writing around particularly Shawnee people and other tribal people here in this part of Ohio, particularly like The Frontiersman and the other sort of historical fiction series by Alan Eckert, the plays that were largely written by Alan Eckert, what I call the Eastern dramas. So you have your Western dramas and your spaghetti Westerns and the sort of that kind of thing. There's a similar sort of movement happening in American media to sort of, you know, recapture the American frontier in a different way. And so I think a lot of people, especially some older generations growing up that were kind of in the midst of this from the sort of 50s to the 70s, you know, there was this really strong movement to kind of recapture parts of American identity, not only diversifying the American identity, but also sort of trying to re-solidify what the values of the United States are. And so these stories about Native people and the interactions between the U.S. and Native people kind of served as settings to exemplify some of these virtues and values. And so oftentimes when we hear these legends about people like Tecumseh and Blue Jacket and, you know, Little Turtle and, you know, et cetera, Sitting Bull, most of what they're saying is not much different from what pretty much anybody in that community would say. So when we see these people sort of deified or you know, lifted into legend, I do think that there is a positive aspect to that. Even if some of it's not particularly true, I do appreciate the fact that it keeps it alive in the minds of Americans where it would otherwise be forgotten. But my encouragement is always that they seek to learn beyond that, right? When it comes to history, in my opinion, there's a lot more to be learned from the realities of history than, you know, what we portray and, you know, invent about history. So, you know, when we're thinking about how the United States is choosing to frame and tell stories, like I said, oftentimes it's a progression of military events. Everybody frames their lives around sort of what military event the United States is engaged in at any point in time, which makes sense given how often the United States is in conflict. But what that leads to, I think, is sort of military virtues and sort of military culture being integrated into a lot of other aspects of American life, especially in storytelling, you know, where we really see these concepts of right and wrong, of morality and, you know, victory and sort of justifications for certain things that are going on that are contemporary, that each generation looks back, you know, to the past in some way and says, well, we're different from those, from that, you know, what they did was wrong and they just didn't know it. But what we're doing is right and we know it. And so, like I mentioned, Tecumseh, Sitting Bull, there are lots of these sort of martyrs in American history, especially American Indian martyrs. And what has happened is, you know, like I said, the words that Tecumseh said and what is actually attributed to him, not much different from what you would get from any real, you know, decent Shawnee person at that time. What Sitting Bull said, you know, Black Elk, any, you know, Seattle, any of these people, they're representing their community. And that's how these leaders are looked at from our perspective, is that they represent what we believe as a whole. But in the eyes of the United States, often they're lifted beyond that. They are separated from the community. So these Indians are one thing, but Tecumseh is an exception, right? And so he is intellectually, spiritually, and morally separate from the rest of Shawnee people. So not only does this serve to dehumanize the rest of the population, but it also serves as a very vibrant, very well-known, and extremely virtuous target. And so when he is eventually and ultimately conquered, as is the natural destiny of things in the United States, it serves two purposes. Not only does it serve to uber glorify the sort of divine right of the United States to conquest and to this mission of imperialism and expansion, it also serves as a cautionary tale to say, doesn't matter how great you are, how virtuous you are, how right you are, this is divine providence. This is the way that things must be. And so you see that exemplified in these people like Tecumseh and Sitting Bull and the Prophet and Crazy Horse and Seattle and all of these native leaders who have opposed colonization at different points in time. They are ultra glorified and turned into idols to be sacrificed at the altar of the United States to prove how worthy the U.S. is of its divine conquest.
The belief in the divine right of settlement, that God had ordained and mandated the white settlement of Ohio and other parts of what is now the United States, changed over time and became a strong strain of American individualism after the United States broke away from Great Britain. Before then, God's divine mandate came through the king, who governed through a divine right. But after the Revolution, Americans viewed the divine right as belonging to the people, that is, white settlers.
Previously, you would have been fighting for king and country. You would have been fighting for the divine right of your nation, of its sovereign, to whatever had been agreed to, you know, on paper. And now there is a new sort of paradigm being introduced, which is that, you know, you're fighting for you, you know, you're conquering for you. You as an individual are now doing these things and fighting these wars for your own benefit. So, you know, I think that also spurs a whole new level of drive to push this campaign west, to sort of push through these tribal nations that have been holding this door closed for centuries. And that does breed a new kind of animosity towards tribal people, not on a political scale, but on a personal scale, because now you are directly challenging my well-being, my prosperity, and my sort of family's continuance. You know, you are a direct obstacle to that now. And people like Tecumseh begin to be the symbols of that problem.
After the Treaty of Greenville, Tecumseh took on the role of negotiator and orator. He and his brother helped drive the public discourse in the Ohio country.
Tecumseh and his brother, Tenskwatawa, are sort of two hands of the same sort of machine, right? They represent a political and spiritual movement that's happening simultaneously, that's feeding each other. Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa are both charismatic figures. You know, they have both sort of risen to prominence in their own individual ways. While Tecumseh is out sort of interacting with people and spreading, you know, the word of sort of native unity and sort of resisting colonization as a joint effort, and strength in numbers and, you know, sort of all of these things that seem to be the solution to problems that everyone is facing, Tenskwatawa is offering a sort of different call to action and a return to a sort of perceived golden age of the Indian way of life and sort of thing. You know, they are both sort of working for the same kind of goal, which is to oppose European influence, whether that be geopolitically or socially and religiously. And I think if they would have succeeded, if you know, what they had sort of wanted came to fruition within their lifetimes, what might have happened, you know, would be sort of a reinvention of in a lot of Indian communities, you know, where we see this sort of successful push to resist colonization, to reestablish land holdings from a lot of the different tribes, and then a sort of quick reorganization of a lot of tribal communities, and probably the amalgamation of several tribal communities into larger groups, and then a new and much more, I should say, powerful relationship between the U.S. and you know, this organized group of tribal people. I don't necessarily think Tecumseh and his brother would have been at the head of it necessarily, but I do think that they would have played a very active sort of role in it.
But instead, Tecumseh took to the battlefield during the War of 1812 alongside the British forces in Canada, where he was killed.
So I guess my last question for you is, we've talked a lot about the story of Tecumseh, the sort of Eastern drama, Alan Eckert story of Tecumseh. How do you want the story of Tecumseh to be told? And I guess specifically, just understanding our audience, how are you going to tell the story of Tecumseh to the predominantly non-Native folks that you interact with in your interpretation work?
So the story of Tecumseh, the way that I would encourage people to think about Tecumseh and his life and his legacy, if you remember Tecumseh, if you know his name, you should also know the names of his relatives. You should know his mother, his father, his siblings. He was one of six siblings. And you should know the larger Shawnee community that he represented in his time, because that was his goal, right? His goal was not for self-glorification. He represented the Shawnee community in one way or another. He, you know, when you hear his speeches, understand that the virtues and the sort of ethical things that he's saying, they represent what other Shawnee people believe. And then he fought for the preservation of Shawnee people and community, and he believed that our lands and territory were important to that. So if you're going to honor the legacy of Tecumseh, you need to honor the contemporary Shawnee community. You need to honor what he fought for, which is us. And so understand that we still have an active community today. Tecumseh's descendants are still around today. But, you know, he could be any one of us. You know, his story and his legacy, you know, is evident. Even though he was militarily defeated, the preservation of the Shawnee people is happening. It's current, you know, and so he did succeed in that realm. He bought us more time, and his sacrifice is something that, you know, we honor today, understanding that, you know, we have now inherited that active choice that he was talking about. You know, we have the ability to choose what we want to do, so long as we have the freedom to make that choice. So that's what we fight for today. You know, we encourage other people, especially our American neighbors and et cetera, to come and rebuild relationships. You know, we're doing our best to do outreach, but, you know, we'd appreciate the effort from a much larger community to sort of come find us, come talk with us, and really understand that we would like to sort of rebuild relationships that have been damaged over the last couple hundred years.
That was Talon Silverhorn, citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma, descendant of the Shawnee leader Blue Jacket, and a professional historic interpreter. You've been listening to The Ohio Country from the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. In Episode 8, we'll hear about the removal of the Shawnee people from the Ohio country from Laura Day, an Eastern Shawnee citizen and poet.
As long as I can remember, I have known that I am an Indigenous person, that I'm a Shawnee person. I do think that that sense of erasure or the idea of how a removal sort of echoes across the generations. That came to me very young. I think it came to me so young that I can't even quite remember when I started to think about that. But I think it's important that that knowledge and that quest to better understand our homeland, it did come in the context of being with my tribe.
That's coming up in Episode 8, The Removals.
This was Episode 7 of The Ohio Country, called Tecumseh's Legacy, written by Nina Ellis. Chris Welter interviewed Talon Silverhorn, a citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. The editor of The Ohio Country is Samantha Summer. Dr. John Bickers is our cultural advisor. He's an assistant professor at Case Western University and a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Our logo was designed by Layla Troyer, also a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Flawn Williams is the audio mixer, and the composer is Evan Miller. Thanks again to the Miamia Center at Miami University, public radio station WGTE in Toledo, and Claire Roth from the Ohio Newsroom. I'm the digital assets producer, Mary Evans. To find photographs, maps, and links, go to wyso.org/podcast. This program is made possible through a partnership with Ohio Humanities, a nonprofit that shares stories to spark conversations and inspire ideas, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, a More Perfect Union Initiative. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the Ohio Humanities or the National Endowment for the Humanities.
To see visual content related to The Ohio Country, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And for a full transcript of every episode made by humans, go to wyso.org.
Hello again. Now that you've heard this episode, let me explain again. This 12-part series was made at a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio called WYSO. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO staff and infrastructure to get the job done. So we'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org. Thanks.